This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. The rise of conspiracy theories is part of a very disturbing evolution in the United States and beyond. For example, among the rioters who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of 2021 were followers of the far-right movement QAnon. And it's sometimes easy to forget that those followers are people. With family and friends. So what if your parent, sibling, spouse, best friend fell down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole? What would you do? How far would you go to bring them back? Investigative reporter Jesslyn Cook lays these quandaries bare in her new book. It is called The Quiet Damage, QAnon and the Destruction of the American Family. I spoke with Jesslyn about her book a couple of weeks ago. We have all heard of QAnon, but beyond knowing that it is full of conspiracy theories, does this community, I don't even know if community is the right word, have any core beliefs?
Yes, they do. So the true believers, I'll call them, of QAnon, they think that Donald Trump and a mysterious government insider known as Q are perpetually in the final stages of a treacherous, unseen battle to liberate humanity from the deep state, a satanic cabal of globalist elites who rule the world from the shadows while buying and selling children to rape, mutilate, and eat. A lot of the ideology is extremely gruesome, but I do think it's worth noting that QAnon has kind of become an umbrella movement that embodies a lot of people, not just who are those diehard true believers, but who espouse a lot of the theories without calling themselves QAnon believers.
Where did it come from? Where did QAnon start?
QAnon started as a fringe conspiracy theory on the internet, on 4chan, progressed through 8chan and 8kun. But what's really been alarming to watch is how it has emerged from the fringes of the internet into something that's really affecting our everyday lives. Its conspiracy theories have diluted and kind of mainstreamed into our political culture in a way that really does not feel fringe at all.
Give me an example. I can think of Pizzagate, but give me another example.
Well, I think even the word pedophile is weaponized a lot in our current political climate. Obviously, child trafficking, child abuse is a very real and serious issue, but it now seems almost like a new Red Scare era where when there's a politician or someone you don't like, the default is to just call them a pedophile because it's something we can all stand together and say we are against pedophilia and against harm to children. But just the kind of mainstreaming of that term and using it as just a way to bring down someone you don't like to pass blame at a political figure is really frightening.
Okay, so as I said in the introduction, you were a longtime tech reporter. You're now an investigative reporter. What was your introduction to QAnon and its followers? Like, why do you even want to get involved in this?
So my background coming into reporting on conspiracy theories and mis and disinformation is actually pretty interesting. I grew up in Canada. Went to school for journalism at Carleton in Ottawa, and I really immersed myself in the political culture there. Then I moved to the States just ahead of the 2016 election, and the contrast was really jarring for me. This was a time when Donald Trump was calling the media the enemy of the people, spreading a lot of lies and falsehoods, and the Pizzagate conspiracy theory was really taking off. And it was just something I'd really never seen before coming from Canada, from Ottawa. And so that got me interested in reporting on what is true, what is false, where these kind of theories originate from, how we interpret this information. And fast forward to 2020, in the pandemic, the early months of the pandemic, I found myself at a QAnon rally in Hollywood. I was living in LA at the time. It was the first time I'd really seen QAnon come to life. It was no longer confined to the internet. There were 1,000 people marching down Hollywood Boulevard with signs in their hands like Scamdemic won't hide Pedogate. Just a lot of really wild stuff to see face to face when it had been online for so long. And so that really set off alarm bells for me and really underscored the importance and the urgency that we better understand this and how so many people are getting sucked into this way of thinking.
Paint a picture of that rally, because I think people have in their minds a certain idea of what they think someone at a QAnon rally might look like. But can you just tell me, like, what kinds of people were there?
It was one of the wildest experiences of my life. Some of the signs I can't repeat on air because they were just so vile, but a lot of the QAnon conspiracy theories are, they center around sexual abuse of children and satanic abuse of children. There are theories that Democratic elites are filleting them alive, drinking their blood, really, really terrible stuff. And so this rally, it was just this huge swarm of people. They were chanting the QAnon rally, where we go one, we go all. And what was so stunning to me was that these were not maybe the kind of person who would come to mind when you're thinking of like an Alex Jones era conspiracy theorist. These were not like basement dwelling people who would you think of in the shadows. These were, you know, parents were there with their children. There were, I spoke to one woman at this rally who was actively working as a family therapist in LA. They were quote unquote normal looking people who genuinely, I spoke to a lot of them. They felt like they were there standing up for what was right and doing what they believed in.
You saw a kid with a specific sign that sort of, you know, initiated or further initiated for you that you wanted to do a deeper dive into QAnon. So tell me about this child.
Yeah, that was a really disturbing moment for me. There was a man at this rally who approached me. He saw the press badge around my neck. He was yelling at me that as part of the media, I was complicit in what the cabal, the deep state, was up to. That's part of the belief system. But holding his hand was this boy who was maybe six, and he had a shirt on that it said, "I'm not for sale" on one side and Adrenochrome on the back with a capital N-O in the middle. And Adrenochrome is that theory, again, that the elites are drinking children's blood basically as immortality elixirs. What was so frightening to me in that moment was I was just looking at this kid and kind of wondering, like, what are you being told at home? What are you going to grow up believing? Where is this country heading, where we really are having a harder and harder time agreeing on what is true and what is false? And so that kind of inspired me to go on and do more reporting in this field. And I ended up writing a piece on children of QAnon believers and what it is like to have a parent who you kind of are trying to explain right from wrong, true from false, and become a self-taught deprogrammer. So that was what really got the ball rolling for me on this project.
So it's not just kids who have parents or parents who have kids, it's siblings, it's aunts, it's friends. And you spoke to hundreds of people, hundreds of families who told you about their loved ones who have fallen under the spell or the belief system of QAnon. And the people you speak with, Jesslyn, I don't know, maybe there's an exception, but almost always ask for anonymity. Why is that?
The people who, if you have a loved one who falls into this, I think there's just so much shame and stigma surrounding it. You know, like if your friend asks you, "How are you doing?" It's one thing to say, "I'm having a tough time." It's another thing to say, "Well, I'm okay, but my mom thinks Hillary Clinton eats babies." It's embarrassing on the one hand. So that those are the loved ones who I think just feel a great deal of shame and embarrassment around this. On the other, I do speak to several believers in the book, QAnon believers and former believers. And there's a lot of hostility between conspiracy theorists and the media, who are viewed as journalists, are viewed as part of the problem here. So those are some of the reasons why I do use anonymity in this book to protect people's privacy. And I think it's tempting to just kind of point, laugh, and ridicule this condition. I see that happen a lot, but that really is not productive. And I think that is why you see so much anonymity when reporters are talking about this.
Yeah, I've been refraining using the word, you know, the phrase, like, this just all sounds bonkers, because to your point, it hasn't paid many dividends in terms of quelling conspiracy theories or conspiracy theorists. So given that, how much headway are the beliefs of QAnon making? Well, let's say in the American context, how much headway?
The belief system just always adapts, you know, again and again and again. QAnon theories will not come to fruition. You know, Donald Trump was not supposed to lose in 2020. All the bad guys, quote unquote bad guys, Joe Biden, all his cronies were supposed to be hauled off to Gitmo or executed in the streets. It's just every time there's a belief that's built up, it falls apart. But the really remarkable thing about these conspiracy theories is that the believers are almost never dissuaded. They can always kind of pivot and find a new way to keep on believing. And so to answer your question, no, they really have not come to bear in any case. There are a lot of real conspiracies and corruption that have gone on that have kind of solidified people's disillusionment and suspicion, I guess I'll say. But in this case, no, but despite all of that, QAnon, while the branding has faded, the believers are absolutely still there.
Yeah, and there's a recent poll, Public Religion Research Institute poll, that showed 1 in 5 Americans believe in QAnon theories to some degree. And that goes back to your point at the beginning, where it's like some people are really deep and some people are in, but don't even kind of recognize or want to admit that they're in.
1 in 5 Americans, that's greater than the entire population of Canada. That's a staggering number. And QAnon, I think, even Q, this kind of shadowy online figure, directed followers to shed the branding, to, you know, keep pushing the ideas, keep pushing the disinformation. But there's an understanding, I think, at this point that QAnon, the name, has kind of started to turn people off. So it's gone a little underground. But really, to me, it's just blended in more than anything.
In your book, you share the stories of 5 families, a diverse range of people, different ages, gender, socioeconomic background, political beliefs. What's the common thread, though, with these families that you profiled who were drawn into QAnon?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got like a wealthy white lawyer from a very privileged background, a Black millennial mother who struggled with extreme poverty, an elderly retiree, even a 7-year-old, tragically, and other people from all, you know, liberals, conservatives, and you know, I think the kind of stereotypical conspiracy theorist is, at least in the States, kind of this white boomer Trump voter type. But there is no demographic box. The commonality really comes down to a sense of powerlessness, valid or not. So what might be surprising to some people, and early on, what was surprising to me to some degree, is that marginalized communities can actually be quite ripe for conspiracy theory thinking in some cases. For these groups, belief in conspiracy nonsense can actually make a lot of sense. Feelings of powerlessness can be entrenched from generations of legitimate oppression. So this kind of seemingly paranoid conspiracy theorizing can actually be a form of adaptive hypervigilance. Like in the US, we have a long history of racist government-sponsored medical experiments against the Black community, the infamous Tuskegee study. So it's with that kind of context in mind, it's maybe not surprising that early in the COVID pandemic, for instance, vaccination levels were low among Black Americans. These kinds of historical traumas have absolutely left people feeling powerless and suspicious. But to your point, Pia, even the privileged can be conditioned to feel powerless, you know, to have this victim mentality. If you turn on Fox News, you will hear again and again how the powers that be are out to get you, are pushing the quote unquote trans agenda on your children, are censoring your speech, are trampling all over your rights and freedoms. I think it is much easier to fall for anti-establishment conspiracy theories when you've already been conditioned to identify as a victim of the establishment.
Hmm. If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm speaking with journalist Jesalyn Cook. She has a new book out. It's called The Quiet Damage, QAnon and the Destruction of the American Family. So Jesalyn, when you see people getting drawn into this, how would you describe like their personality shifts of those who have become part of the QAnon movement?
I think for their loved ones, to watch someone you love go through this, it's almost like watching them transform into a stranger. Person after person has described to me how their mother or their uncle or their best friend, who they know to be kind and intelligent, has become irrational, illogical, cruel, even extremely defensive, and trying to debunk their beliefs, even if it comes from a good place, actually backfires and just kind of inspires a really nasty reaction. So it's extremely painful to lose someone to that kind of ideology. And I think what it shows is that in many cases, the issue here is not really the information itself. Like to try to debunk and tackle the disinformation is kind of addressing the symptom, not the cause. For a lot of these people who hold on to these beliefs, it's not really about what they think is true or false. It's about what that conviction makes them feel. Maybe it gives them a sense of community. Maybe it gives them a sense of purpose to feel like a digital soldier in this online movement where they're very important and they matter. But from the outside, to watch someone go through this, where they're suddenly spewing all kinds of wild theories, saying Wayfair sells storage cabinets with missing kids locked inside, it's just boggling and extremely painful.
As I said, you profile a handful of families, and I want to ask you to kind of describe the emotional toll on a particular family. This is the case of a mom who disowns her son after he challenges her. She's the QAnon believer, and he challenges her beliefs. So paint a picture of the emotional toll this had on family members.
Yeah, her son, Adam, So tragically, he has already lost one parent. His father died by suicide. And so to watch his mother slip away into this mindset, he felt like he was losing the only parent he had left. And so he really just upended his entire life desperately trying to save her. That was how he described it to me, was he was trying to save her before it was too late. You know, he was missing deadlines at work. He was letting go of friendships. He was spending all of his time trying to make her understand that what she was saying wasn't true, trying to get through to her. But the more he tried, the more he was pushing her away. And the really heartbreaking thing was that QAnon didn't just destroy her life. It really destroyed his in a way too. It just completely broke him down, and he gave everything he had trying to help her. But as I was alluding to earlier, fact-checking can be very counterproductive. And even though he went about it wanting to help her, it really had the opposite effect.
So that idea that people said, well, just, you know, give them the facts. Tell them here's, you know, we always say, like, get your facts from reliable sources. That doesn't seem to work with people who are QAnon believers. But you also write about people finding their way out of that world. So how did family members reach them to say, like, you know, we're going to help you. We're going to get you out of this.
I think what really does make a difference, and if people are listening who have a loved one going through this, it's worth considering not just the what of belief, but the why. And what I mean by that is not focusing on what the person is saying, the stuff that maybe they say Taylor Swift is a government psyop. You just kind of put that aside and ask yourself, why are they holding on to these beliefs so desperately? What does espousing these beliefs do for them? What needs does it satisfy? One character in my book, he went through a really debilitating injury, and he really felt like he was losing his sense of purpose. He could no longer provide for his wife or his children in the ways that he used to. His job didn't need him to the same degree anymore. He spent a lot of his day sitting in a chair, and it, you know, that takes a toll on you. And he just felt like a very diminished sense of purpose. But then he discovered QAnon, where every day he got to show up online and be someone who mattered, be someone who was part of a collective good fighting for a greater cause. And that meant so much to him. It really helped him kind of shut off his critical thinking, and his logic was overpowered by emotion. And so the takeaway is, what ended up making a difference for him and what has made a difference for so many others I've spoken to is trying to address, instead of the false information with fact-checking, trying to address that underlying need. So it was, in his case, after he was able to restore that very broken sense of purpose, that was when he stopped clinging to his belief system, because he just didn't need it anymore. It was no longer necessary to give him that sense of purpose, because he had addressed that instead.
So these are the individual efforts families and loved ones are doing. There are also efforts more broadly. We see the spread of QAnon theories on digital platforms, things like chat rooms, social media, YouTube. And so we know that some of the, at least social media sites, have introduced measures to combat disinformation, fact-checking labels on fake stories. So on that end of things, in terms of what companies are doing, how much of a dent do you think it's going to make to challenge the spread of QAnon conspiracy theories?
You know, not to sound like too much of a pessimist, because I do want to acknowledge some good work has been done in this space, but a lot of damage has been done too. We really didn't see these big tech companies take decisive action until they were called out by journalists and the public, and there was public outcry. But in the meantime, you know, a lot of platforms didn't really address their QAnon issue that had been bubbling up for a long time until it was already much too late, and we were approaching, in the States, the 2020 election. And so in that time, as you pointed out, 1 in 5 Americans now hold some of these beliefs. So many people fell in through these rabbit holes, fell into these echo chambers online, where you get a really distorted version of reality, that it's going to take a lot more to address this crisis. You know, trying to adjust the algorithms now, that's good. And I'm, you know, fact-checking labels can help in some cases, but it's not going to undo all the harm that was caused in the interim.
And here we are, as Americans are just a few months away from voting for the next president. Is this about Donald Trump, or is this movement now beyond that? Because some people say, oh, there's the CBC again, you know, crapping on Donald Trump, for example. And I just want to get a sense of what your understanding of this movement is now in 2024.
QAnon does not need Donald Trump. Donald Trump has maybe tacitly acknowledged and even kind of nodded to QAnon in a few cases. But no, QAnon has definitely grown far beyond that. It's bled into our culture, our politics. It's not just Donald Trump. You know, we have been grappling with false information even before Donald Trump came along. I think a lot of people like to point the finger at him because obviously he has spread a lot of false information. But no, it's definitely grown beyond him, and it's a little unnerving to think where it may go next.
And for those people who say, oh, big problem in the United States, we don't got that problem where we live here in Canada or elsewhere. Where else in the world is QAnon politically active?
No, QAnon is active in Canada, and I think some of that, you know, even with this faded branding of QAnon, let's say, with these ideas, I think in Canada and in many other countries around the world, we really saw distrust rising and the suspicion rising over the pandemic for a lot of different reasons. It was just really conducive climate for false information to spread. The Trucker Freedom Convoy was really an inflection point. You know, we saw a lot of people come out standing up for perceived violations of their rights, but there was this powerful cross current of anti-vaccine and anti-establishment disinformation that has long outlasted the protests themselves.
And there are people who say there were lots of just regular folks out there protesting against what they didn't want to see the governments doing. And that's where it all gets murky, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of times people who get into conspiracy theories are standing up for what they view as an injustice. And then, you know, we see a lot of opportunists and grifters kind of latching on to that righteous anger and twisting it and filling information voids with false narratives at a time when people are vulnerable and emotional.
There's someone listening to us right now who's saying, oh, I'm going to send this to my parent, kid, brother, sister, however it works, friend, who is a believer in conspiracy theories. And they say, well, listen to this conversation and that'll just clear things right up. I'm guessing you're going to say, Jocelyn, that it won't. So what would you suggest they do as a first step?
A lot of people who have come to me asking about their loved ones and how they can help them, they've exhausted a lot of options and they've already kind of moved past the calmly speaking to their loved ones stage towards the like screaming matches. And I absolutely understand how it gets to that point because it can be infuriating trying to convince someone of something that's so obviously true or trying to dissuade them of something that's so obviously false. I think it's important to try to hold on to compassion. I know that's asking a lot in some cases, but what's important is if you can, really not to ridicule these beliefs, even though they are ridiculous, because if you don't show this person that they can come out of QAnon or come out of conspiracy theories, still feeling loved and respected and like someone you value, why would they come out? You know, there's so much support in this rabbit hole there. There's such a good community there. If they don't feel like they can emerge still having your respect and your admiration, they're not going to come out. And so trying to establish and maintain that pathway for them while challenging is probably the most important piece of advice I can give.
It's a really important conversation that we're having, and I thank you for it and thank you for your book. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Jocelyn Cook is an investigative reporter as well as the author of a book called The Quiet Damage: QAnon and the Destruction of the American Family. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.